two graphic biographies, one of Edward Snowden.
The Snowden story, in my view, the Snowden revelations are the most important news story of my lifetime, bar none. So I wanted to do something about it.
That's Ted Rall talking about his new book, Snowden. And then British cartoonist Kate Evans tells us about Rosa Luxemburg. Her graphic biography is called Red Rosa.
She's the person to whom I would apply the epithet indomitable, actually, because she seems to have an ability to completely ignore anything that should be holding her back. You know, she's got a severe disability, she's a woman, she's a refugee, she's Jewish, she is facing multiple handicaps, and she simply just doesn't engage with that.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Ted Rall is quite possibly America's most revolutionary political cartoonist. Witness his book, The Anti-American Manifesto, which we spoke to him about in 2011. His acerbic drawings have been skewering American political life for a long time, ruffling the feathers of politicians and mainstream media alike. Now he's turned his prolific drawing pens to biography. Today we talk with him about his biography of Edward Snowden, published earlier this year by Seven Stories Press. And he's about to release a biography of Bernie Sanders, which we'll be talking to him about early in 2016. In his biography of Edward Snowden, Rall reveals new details about Snowden's escape from Hong Kong and shares some of his theories on what makes Snowden tick, why he and none of the other 1.4 million people who knew about it blew the whistle on the all-pervasive and illegal surveillance of Americans by the NSA. But Rall also explains the NSA programs themselves in vivid detail and how they pose an unprecedented political and technological threat to democracy. I spoke with Ted Rall in November, soon after the first Democratic debate, where Snowden was discussed. Ted Rall, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
So your latest book is Snowden. Is this your first biography?
Yes, it is.
Why did you decide to write a graphic book about Edward Snowden?
It was my publisher's idea. Seven Stories Press came to me and said, asked me if I'd like to do it. And it sounded immediately like something I'd be interested in because, first of all, I love biographies. I read a lot of them. I've always wanted to write one. And I was fascinated with the Snowden story. In my view, the Snowden revelations are the most important news story of my lifetime, bar none. So I wanted to do something about it. The only question was really how to go about it. And in terms of format, I knew that I could see the benefit of the comics format, specifically toward the view of explaining the programs that are so complicated, that where charts and graphics are useful. In fact, the government agrees because they explain those programs internally using charts and diagrams in PowerPoint. So it made sense to do it graphically. The only question was really sort of how to structure the book and what needed to be in it and what didn't need to be in it.
The most important story of your lifetime. Explain.
Well, I know people are thinking about, I'm 52 years old, and people will think about Vietnam or Kent State or the 9/11 attacks, but those all pale in significance for me, because the NSA revelations exposed the nature of the government and its true relationship with the American people. We've all been raised since taking civics class in high school and in elementary school to believe that the American government is a government for the people, of the people, and by the people. But what we're revealing is that really that's not true. The government is, in fact, views us all as potential enemies of the state and as possible terrorists and criminals, and also views us all as having no intrinsic, basic, fundamental privacy rights and is willing to trample even the U.S. Constitution in order to indulge in the mass surveillance of every human being on the planet and to expose every iota of private communication and private life that they might have. So what it exposes is that we live in a police state. It exposes the fact that the U.S. government is not for the people or by the people or of the people. It's above the people and it's outside the law. And it shows us the kind of government that we're dealing with. We are not in a different situation than the East Germans were under the Stasi.
You also, in this book, Snowden, you start out with talking about George Orwell's 1984.
Yeah, and you know, that's kind of a cliche whenever you talk about privacy or anything related to the NSA. And the reason I ended up using that metaphor anyway and that opening was because of one particular NSA program that blew me away. There's a program that allows them to turn on the camera on your smart TV and watch you inside your room while you're watching TV, even if the TV is unplugged. So, and there's another program that allows them to turn on your cell phone, even if it's powered down, and use it as a microphone to spy on you inside your house or your office or wherever you are. And those two programs in particular made me think of 1984. That is the vision of 1984, not just that you're tracked or that security cameras see you in the street, but that even in the privacy of your home, you are viewed through, in 1984, a telescreen that allowed the party to watch people inside their homes. And we have the same exact technology available to the U.S. government.
Yeah, this really shocks me, but also puzzles me. Do you have any idea how they accomplish this just technologically? If your phone is turned off or your TV is turned off, how are they able to use them as listening or viewing devices?
There's still a little bit of residual power in your phone and in your TV that is necessary to keep all the settings going for a long time. So, for example, after a power outage, your TV comes back and doesn't need all to be reset. Think about when you buy your TV, you have to add all sorts of settings to it when you first install it. But those settings are all there, even if the power is out for a couple of days and they come back. Similarly, if you're phone is out of power for a few days, but you still have your contacts. All the phone numbers are still in there. That's from the residual power. The NSA exploits that power.
Now, back when the Snowden revelations first happened, there was a whole lot of talk about, well, we just see the metadata. I can remember Obama saying, we don't actually record any of your phone calls. So first of all, talk about that as an issue, whether that's just a red herring in and of itself. And then the fact, I mean, you just said they can listen to anything of ours. They can watch us in any way. Talk about some of the other ways in which they are, in fact, recording everything.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because the Telephony Metadata Program, which is the basically the interception with the cooperation of the major telecoms like Sprint and AT&T, there's only one company that doesn't cooperate, which is T-Mobile. But all the other companies do this. They are intercepting what is basically the information on your phone bill, what time you called, how long you were on the phone, who you called, where you were when you called, if it was a cell phone, where they were when they received the call. And it is true that that particular program doesn't intercept the voice content of the call. And that's because they have another program that does that. And then the defenders of that program say, well, that doesn't store the information. And that's true because they have another program that stores it and allows them to go back as far as 5 years. The program is called Retro. And I'm sure they can go back further now, because bear in mind, the Snowden revelations date from 2009 to 2012. It's now 2015. Technology is jumping by leaps and bounds moving forward. And obviously, storage capacity is much more efficient and cheaper. And so it's obvious that they're going to be able to go back more than 5 years by this point. It's all searchable by voice and by keywords. So, for example, you could put in Joe Biden's voice and then find every instance of Joe Biden talking on a telephone in the world over the last 5 years just by inputting that as a search at NSA in their data farm in Utah. Or you could similarly put in a keyword and say, I want every mention of the word of asparagus in the state of Ohio and Nebraska between February and March of this year, and they will find it. So there's a lot of different ways to analyze this data, but we are talking about not just NSA and CIA programs that intercept every communication that you can imagine, but also other agencies that nobody talks about. Now, among the NSA programs, you're talking about the ability to intercept banking records. And I don't mean the ability. They actually do intercept all of them. Text messages, voice over internet. They're even intercepting our Netflix streaming, so they know what TV and movie shows we're watching. Our library borrowing records. They're literally up into everything. So if you have emailed it, if you have faxed it, if you have telexed it, if you have called it, it has been intercepted and stored on that data farm in Bluffdale, Utah. But there's also programs that nobody thinks about. For example, the U.S. Post Office has something called the Mail Covers Program, which is 100 years old and has now been expanded to photograph, scan, and analyze the outside of every piece of mail in the United States every single day. So when you send a letter, whether it be a bill or a thank you card to grandma or whatever it is, that is stored by the U.S. Postal Service and is kept in a big database and analyzed. Similarly, there are automatic license plate readers that are used by every major metropolitan police department in the United States and a lot of small ones, including East Hampton, New York, where I live, where they just sit on the street or they're attached to a squad car. And unbeknownst to the innocent law-abiding citizens who are driving by, they're automatically being recorded by the billions every single year. So they're able to know where people go on a day-to-day basis. Now, that might sound pretty boring and harmless, but, you know, it might not be so boring and harmless if you are A, an enemy of the state, and B, maybe you're cheating on your spouse. That could become the kind of information that could be used to compromise you. And in fact, Edward Snowden revealed that there is a specific program directed at political enemies of the state and in order to unmask their sexual habits. And this is very reminiscent to older listeners to the old FBI's COINTELPRO program from the late 1960s and early 1970s. And it goes back to the raids of the 1920s under Hoover and the FBI. I mean, this is the Palmer raids. These are very old kind of tactics, and they're kind of idiotic. And it's a great, huge misuse of resources when you think about the fact that there are schools that are going begging for renovations and for decent equipment. But this is what they're doing. It's a vast business. This is about money more than it is about security.
This is about money?
This is a vast segment of the American economy. One of the statistics that blew me away when I was researching this book was the fact that 1.4 million people had access to some or all of the same documents that Snowden took. Now, the first thing that made me think of was, why are so few people willing to step up? Basically, over the last 15 years, it's only been Snowden and one other person named Tom Drake who have ever stepped forward and blown the whistle on the NSA. So why them, and why did the other 1,399,000 stay silent? And then the other thing that it made me think about was the size of the security apparatus. I mean, if you're talking about a country with 320 million people, the workforce is roughly about 170 to 180 million people. So if 1.4 million people have access to that specific information, then you know many more times that are still members of the intelligence community, either directly or indirectly, who have access to other data, but not that. So it starts to look a lot like East Germany, where it turned out that when the Stasi went out of business, they were a major employer at East Germany. They lived in a security state where people were paid to spy, sometimes on their own spouses and on their own children and on their own parents. We're not far from that. If the NSA, the DIA, which is the Defense Intelligence Agency, the CIA, the FBI, and the other 20 or so domestic intelligence agencies were to be put out of business, along with all of the subcontractors like the one that Snowden worked for, Booz Allen Hamilton in Honolulu, if these guys were all to go under, it would be a huge shock to the U.S. economy. A lot of unemployment, a lot of economic activity would cease to exist. I mean, you'd be looking at something akin to the 2008 housing bubble crash.
Ted Rall, in your book, Snowden, you go into not so much the economic aspect. I think that this is another wrinkle and a very dismaying one. You go deeply into exactly what Snowden revealed about us. You also go into why it was him. I mean, you just said, you know, why did not anybody else of these 1.4 million people do what he did? Why do you think Snowden... why was he a whistleblower? And he was actually somebody who didn't have very kind words for whistleblowers earlier in his life.
Well, what's interesting is that there's really no unique thing about Snowden. I was talking to Chris Hedges about this the other day. We had a joint appearance together in New York, and he was pointed out rightfully that Snowden and other whistleblowers are very clear that they are not different birds, that really they're just like anybody else. They don't want whistleblowing to be an exotic activity that is only good for a few people of rare integrity or whatever. They think it's something that everybody can and should do, and they don't want it to be exotic. But they also have the benefit of, I think, being truthful. I mean, I interviewed Drake, I researched Snowden and Drake, and there's really nothing about them that is particularly interesting or different from anybody else. I mean, you know, I try a little bit of armchair psychology in my book. And I point out the fact that, you know, maybe his faith in the system was shaken up when his parents got divorced in Snowden's case. Or maybe the fact that he was a Boy Scout imbued him with these values of honesty and trustworthiness. Or maybe the fact that he loved to play video games where the rules are clear and you can't cheat and everything has to be on the up and up. Maybe that was it. Who knows? But there's no one thing. I mean, all you really can say is that somehow these guys were wired to recognize that something terrible was going on and to be willing to risk themselves and their lives in order to make that information public. And what that really is about integrity. You're faced with an existential dilemma where you have made two promises. In both Snowden's and Drake's case, they said they had promised to keep classified information confidential. And obviously, that's a reasonable request on the part of the government. You can't have a security apparatus without having that requirement. And obviously, you do need some state secrets. But at the same time, they both witnessed violations of privacy rights and of the NSA's charter on a vast scale. And the NSA, just for people who are not aware of this, was chartered in 1947 for the exclusive interception of foreign signals intelligence, which means that basically if an American is talking to an American and there's a warrant involved, the FBI can spy on them. But if an American's talking to an American only in America, the NSA is not allowed to intercept that communication. And if they do, they're supposed to dispose of it and destroy it right away. That's the opposite, exactly the opposite of what they've been doing. They've been making a huge effort to collect every bit of traffic on the internet and through the air that they possibly can. But that's a big, big thing for people to understand. So Snowden saw this, and as did Drake, and he realized that if he tried to complain within the system, which he did, it was going to be ignored, and that there was no way to go about this in any kind of legal way. It should be pointed out that people have lied about that, most recently and most infamously Hillary Clinton in the Democratic debate said that Snowden had enjoyed federal whistleblower protections and could have stepped forward and not faced prosecution. That's just a lie, and she knows it's a lie. He was not even an NSA employee. He was not a federal U.S. government employee at the time that he fled. He worked for Booz Allen Hamilton.
And so there's no whistleblowing protection?
And there is whistleblowing protection for federal employees, but numerous experts say that it's so weak as to be close to useless. For example, there's an exception carved out for classified and national secrets. So that would obviously cover everything that Snowden revealed because it was all classified. So obviously he wouldn't have been protected even if he had been a federal employee, which he wasn't. So it's kind of a double lie.
So speaking about Hillary Clinton, she was asked in the debate, they were all asked, whether Snowden was a hero. What was your take? You're also writing a book about Bernie Sanders. What's your take on the response that each of them gave in the debate?
It was very disappointing. The answer is that Edward Snowden deserves a ticker tape parade down Broadway. He is one of the great heroes of our time, and we owe him a huge debt to allow us to have this conversation and to be aware of what the government is doing to us and at our expense, it should be pointed out, and illegally. So I thought it was very unfortunate that there was no candidate who was willing to step forward and just say, he's a hero, he deserves our thanks, he should not be prosecuted. And that is an option. You know, there's been some calls for Obama to issue him a presidential pardon. But in a way, the problem with a pardon is that it implies that there was wrongdoing in the first place, which there was not. Snowden did nothing wrong. And what they should do is drop the charges and allow him to return home so he can continue his life and be close to his family and be in his home country.
Well, he did break the law. However, I think your point would be is that he did the higher good. But you just pointed out that the U.S. is massively breaking the law. And there's even been a court case that made that pretty clear that the NSA is breaking the law. What's happened with that?
Well, the problem is that you have a breakdown of the system. I think one of the things that the founding fathers never anticipated when they conceived of the separation of powers was collusion between the three branches of government. And I could see why back in the 1780s, they didn't think that would happen. But that is what you have going on now. So by any objective standard, what the NSA is doing is illegal. In fact, their defenders don't say that it's legal. What they'd say is that it's necessary. Now, what's funny is my argument for Edward Snowden's actions would be exactly the same, that it was necessary. And there is a necessary defense in law. You know, if I see a house on fire and a child is screaming inside, but there's a no trespassing sign on the lawn, I have the right to, in fact, the duty to ignore that no trespassing sign to try to save that child from that burning house. Mm-hmm. And I think that similarly, Snowden has basically saw the Constitution on fire and like rushed in and tried to save what was left of it before it was all burned away, certainly the Fourth Amendment. And in the case of the NSA, they are claiming that they have the necessity to defend America from terrorists. Now, the problem with their argument is that they, unlike Edward Snowden, have the ability to pass new laws and if they want. So, because this is all done under the direction of the Senate Intelligence Committee. So if Feinstein and other senators who support the NSA really believe in what they're doing, what they should do is, in a democracy, is make the case to the American people using the media to say, explain why these programs are necessary and why it's important, it's worth diluting our privacy rights, and pass a law that legalizes these programs. But they've never made any effort to do that. I mean, these programs are not authorized under the Patriot Act. They really don't have a basis in law. And the charter is there, and there's no denying that NSA charter. These programs are illegal. This is a rogue agency gone wild. So it's insane to me that we're having this conversation about what Snowden did. Never mind what Snowden did. What he did was trivial and minor in comparison, even if you buy that it was a bad thing. It was a very minor breach of law compared to what the government is doing.
So, Ted Rall, talk about what's at stake here. You know, I think a lot of people, in fact, I heard you speak at a local library, and there was a man in the audience who asked the classic question, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so why should I care about this?
Yeah, and it's a fair question because it's the first one that pops into your brain because you think, well, I'm not personally, I mean, hell, I even think that. I mean, I know the NSA is directing special attention to me, as they should, because I just wrote a book about Edward Snowden. If they weren't, I would wonder about them. And I also know that they must be terribly bored. You know, it's like, wow, Ted sure does order a lot of paper and ink. You know, I'm not an exciting person to be spied upon. So you think, well, you know, I'm not on the phone with ISIS. Why do I, you know, what's the problem? And it's a fair point, but there's more to it than that, though. I mean, first of all, dealing with the regime exactly the way it is very disturbing to know whenever someone has information that they can use against you, you're never going to feel at ease, even if no one does use it against you. So, for example, if there were nude photos of me, I would rather that those nude photos be under my control or not exist at all than to have them under the control of someone else. So if this other person has those photos and they never release them, I suppose I have nothing to fear. But why should they have that power over me to post those things on the internet? And so similarly, I think that people have to understand that when you have that kind of information out there, it can be used and abused. It's inevitable. And in fact, we already know that it's happened at the NSA because we know that the NSA analysts routinely look up like their girlfriends or girls that they're interested in, or I assume boys that they're interested in as well, information. They run furtive security checks on people that they're interested in. And they could even turn on the cameras of people that they're interested in their home and take nude photos of them. And they do. And they pass them around, the NSA. And Snowden has told us about that too. So that, I think, is kind of, for me, where it begins. But even if you completely accept the idea that the U.S. government is not going to abuse the information that they are going to get, governments change, regimes change, presidents change. So what you might trust the Obama administration to do, if you're a Democrat, you might not trust a Trump or a Carly Fiorina administration to do if you're a Democrat. Conversely, what you might trust a Ted Cruz administration to do if you're a Republican, you might not trust a Bernie Sanders administration to do. Some information is information that nobody should ever have because it could fall into the wrong hands. So even if you have just utmost faith in the current government, you should be concerned. Perhaps not about a foreign invasion, but you just never know what's going to happen. I mean, nothing lasts forever. You know, you can look at the abuses of the Nixon years to see when the executive branch decides to abuse their power and use information that they have against people that they don't like. For example, in Nixon's case, tax audits, abusing the IRS for that and sicking the FBI on them. I mean, Nixon was impeached for really very little compared to what's going on now. I mean, he tapped phones, and that was one of the counts of impeachment. He only tapped 120 people's phones. Barack Obama is tapping 320 million people's phones in the United States alone, billions worldwide.
So now that we've had a couple of years since the revelations came out, do you have any reason for hope? What's changed? What are some of the countervailing forces that you think are happening and that may give us some reason for hope to overturn this surveillance state?
The mainstream political system has failed us. You know, right now we're in the middle of a presidential election, and only one major candidate, Rand Paul, on the Republican side, has said good things about the NSA programs. In other words, he's against them, and he's in favor of pardoning Snowden, or at least going easy on him. But the other ones have all been very bad. And the political debate in the mainstream media, as you pointed out earlier, has been all about the Telefonia Metadata program, which is one tiny program. It's the tip of the iceberg compared to everything that's going on. But what's been interesting has been how the free markets have addressed this issue. It may be that the government may not think that the people care, but businesses and individuals really do care about their privacy, and a lot of them are voting with their feet. So on an international level, American companies have lost billions, possibly trillions of dollars of business so far to foreign companies because they're afraid that companies like Google and other Silicon Valley giants have all been cooperating with NSA. They don't think that their confidential industrial data is safe from the prying eyes of the NSA, which is engaged heavily in industrial espionage, not just looking for terrorists. So there's been a move afoot to build a so-called Eurocloud in Europe, because the cloud is actually run by Google. So there's Alterna clouds that are being built all over, which are going to try to lock the NSA out. Also, encryption is becoming more mainstream. There are apps that you can get for iOS or for Android that allow point-to-point encryption of text messaging and phone calls. For example, I use one called Signal. It's excellent for text messaging. It's point-to-point PGP encrypted, Snowden approved. And then the iPhone 6 series, the 6, the 6 Plus, I forget what the new one is called, those are all completely encrypted. Obviously, it only works if you call another encrypted phone, but a 6 calling a 6 is dark to the NSA, and they're really pissed off about it.
Well, Ted Rall, your books are always entertaining, informing, and about very important critical questions of the day. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks, Francesca. I appreciate it.
Ted Rall is about to come out with a new graphic biography, this time about Bernie Sanders. We'll talk with him about that later in the season. But meanwhile, you can hear what he told me about his take on Sanders and on Hillary Clinton when I spoke with him in November, just after the Democratic debate. Go to writersvoice.net to hear that clip. You can also read an excerpt from his book, Snowden. Next up, a new graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg. Stick around. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Today, we're featuring the work of two political cartoonists who have come out with graphic biographies of inspirational people. We spoke with Ted Rall about Edward Snowden. Kate Evans' biography is about a giant in the history of the political left, Rosa Luxemburg. Luxemburg overcame incredible challenges to become one of the most brilliant critics of capitalism and theoreticians on how to create democratic revolutionary movements against it. She overcame physical disability, sexism, and anti-Semitism to become a leader of the German Social Democratic Party. But she wasn't all politics. She was a brilliantly poetic writer and a believer in the full expression of female sexuality. British cartoonist Kate Evans has been called one of the most original talents in comics by The Guardian newspaper. Her stunning biography about Luxemburg is called Red Rosa. Well, Kate Evans, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This is just a terrific book about one of my heroes, one of those heroes that I've had for years. She inspired me, but I knew very little about her, and now I know a whole lot more. Why did you decide to write a book about Rosa Luxemburg?
Well, I was commissioned because I'm a woman, because the editor of the series, Paul Boole, he's a fantastic comics guy. He's dedicating his retirement to creating graphic biographies of prominent leftist figures. And he was looking for a female comic artist, and my name was suggested to him. So I didn't actually know anything about Rosa Luxemburg at the point when I embarked on the project. In fact, at the point when I answered the email, I got an email saying, would you be interested in writing drawing and perhaps writing graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg. And I went, yes, yes, sure, and sent an email off. And it was only afterwards that I Googled who she was, which isn't very professional, really. But, oh, my gosh, I was absolutely gobsmacked, really, by how – what an amazing person to have as a subject in so many ways. She's inspirational in so many ways.
Yeah, on so many levels. I mean, she was a revolutionary. She was a economic theorist. She was a suffragette. I mean, more than that, she was a feminist. You know, she was a person of unbelievable brilliance. You say a person of audacity and courage. Tell us about Rosa Luxemburg as a person.
Well, that's an interesting question. Now, we have her letters. Verso have put out a 500-page volume of her edited letters, although they're also reproducing all of her work in full, so we will get the full letters in about 10 years' time. So that's lovely because you've got really personal documents, and she just sparkles on the page. The first letter that opens the volume there, she's writing to a friend in Switzerland, and you can just tell she's enthusiastic and interesting, engaged and witty in all these different kinds of ways. She's the person to whom I would apply the epithet indomitable, actually, because she seems to have an ability to completely ignore anything that should be holding her back. You know, she's got a severe disability. She's a woman. She's a refugee. She's Jewish. She is facing multiple handicaps. And she simply just doesn't engage with that. It also makes, I mean, it's interesting, you called her a feminist. Although she is inspirational for women, and she was certainly, you know, she certainly approved of female suffrage and equality, including sexual equality, which she practiced, she also was quite keen not to be sidelined into women's issues. I think at one point she was offered a prominent position within the German Social Democratic Party in charge of female suffrage, and she didn't want anything to do with it because she realised quite rightly that it meant that she would be sidelined from her actual specialism, which is economic theory and Marxist analysis.
That's true, but she also, at least in your book, she does make the point over and over again within the party that women should vote, or that in fact the party was kind of shooting itself in the foot by not having women vote.
Oh yeah, she would definitely engage with issues that are a feminist concern. And if you read some of her writings on women, she writes very sympathetically about proletarian working women. In a way, I think you have to be a woman to make that connection. But she had a bit of a critical distance from the women's suffrage movement at the time because it had very limited aims. If you look at the way that women's suffrage progressed here in the UK, that firstly the vote was given to upper-class women, property-holding women over the age of 30, which is an incredibly small subsection of the female population at the time. But that was the way that it achieved its aims. It was first the upper-class women got the vote, and only later extended to working-class women. And I mean, given that the working classes massively outnumber the upper classes, it makes sense for socialists to press very strongly for women's suffrage. So she supported it in that way. But she was a little bit, she didn't, I don't think she had any time for upper class feminists who had very limited and very, very gradual liberal ideas, because for her it was all about absolute equality and absolute social change, and tackling the root problems of capitalism at their core, not just tinkering with the edges.
Absolutely, about revolution. Now, I just am curious, you knew nothing about her.
Well, I kind of thought, I mean, I've got a background in activism, but it wasn't very well theoretically read. See, in the 1990s, I was living in a tree on the route of the Newbury Bypass, being a road protester and doing practical activism, which then sort of progressed into activism against globalisation, you know, like the World Bank protests. I didn't go to Seattle, but that kind of thing, you know. But I think partly because it was all a bit pre-internet, we didn't really have very much of a theoretical basis to what we were doing. So it's been a great joy to go back and discover the history of resistance and just to really be inspired by how much socialism achieved in the late 19th and early 20th century.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with cartoonist Kate Evans about her graphic biography of the great revolutionary thinker and activist Rosa Luxemburg. It's called Red Rosa and is out from Verso Press. Well, so say more about that and also about Rosa Luxemburg's, how she moved Marxist theory forward, how she actually had a theory of globalization and the reason for it. Connect the dots for us between, you know, what Marx was saying and what she was, you know, agreeing with in terms of Marx, and then how she really pushed it forward, because it seems that it's very relevant to where we are today.
She was thinking about capitalism from first principles. This was at a time when there wasn't such a concept as sort of GDP, gross domestic product. There weren't very many of the economics tools that we have nowadays to think about how nations and how the globe interacts in capitalist terms. Now, she was building on the work of previous economists and Marx, and in The Accumulation of Capital, which is her masterwork, she was addressing the idea that Marx was addressing in Volume 2 of Capital. Now, in that, he envisages that capitalism is a closed system in which everyone is either a worker or a boss. So that's his theoretical point. Rosa Luxemburg takes that and proves that mathematically, if you have money circulating in a closed system within capitalism, then there's nowhere for it to go. Because the workers are working all the time, but they can't have any extra money because they're being exploited to the absolute maximum. The capitalists are extracting as much money from the workers as they can, and then they're producing these products, but then the products then need to be sold to someone. Now, what we've had in the 20th century is an explosion of consumerism, and we're just about to have Christmas, so you can see that on the shelves of the shops, where people go out and buy insane amounts of stuff, and that's what fuels capitalism. But the point is, if you only get your money from within capitalism, where does that money come from? So capitalism can't be a closed system. This is what she proves. And so it has to be parasitic upon non-capitalist systems. And so you get a very clear idea that capitalism is a bit like a sort of a cancer that feeds off anything that's non-exploitative and extracts value from it, from human labour and from the environment. And that was a really stunning realisation. The Accumulation of Capital was partly owing to sexism, extremely badly received by other socialists. She was starting to really annoy many of the other men in this German Social Democracy Party, as far as I can see, because some of them fancied her and she didn't want to go out with them. But the extent to which socialism at the time didn't get that capitalism is bound up with expansionism and with the military-industrial complex, and Rosa did, can be seen in the fact that the German Social Democracy Party, which was the biggest party in the German Reichstag at the time, failed to oppose the First World War. They couldn't see that the First World War was an imperial war of expansion, and Rosa Luxemburg could. And she is the one prominent figure who consistently, from the outset of the war, opposed it. She was joined by Karl Liebknecht, and their stories are generally told together. They were both very famous for opposing the First World War and forming the Spartacists. So she had this very, very deep theoretical understanding of the problems of capitalism, and she wasn't very easily co-opted or swayed from those, which is really refreshing.
Yes. She also tackled head-on the issue, the question of reform or revolution. She did that as early as, I think, when she went to Switzerland and was reading Eduard Bernstein, but then it really came much more to a head when she, in the struggles in the German SPD, because she'd gone to Berlin. Talk about her take on this whole question, reform versus revolution.
She says there's nothing separating socialism from just liberal reformism if you're not committed to revolution, because if you're just tinkering at the edges of the system, there's no difference between you and the capitalists themselves. So I think she says it's more or less like if you're posing the question reform or revolution, the question is to be or not to be. Without revolution, social democracy ceases to exist. Now, I don't agree with all of Luxemburg's I mean, I think there's an extent to which 19th century revolutionaries romanticised revolution, and they could be critiqued for not really having very much in place that was going to work at the point when revolution had happened. And that certainly is the story of German social democracy after the German Revolution. But I do think that it's admirable in its unwavering opposition to the problems of capitalism and its analysis of the problems of capitalism.
Now, when you say the German Revolution, are you referring to what, the 1920s? There was, what are you referring to there in the German?
The bit in 1918, when the First World War ends, which they taught me about in school, and they said, and then the First World War ended and there was an armistice. And they don't say, and then the First World War ended because the working people all over Germany rose up and overthrew the cities and took to the streets and kicked out the government and deposed the Kaiser and instituted a socialist government. That's not the thing that they mention. I mean, people in Germany now, you'll say, and the German Revolution, and they'll go, yeah, well, what revolution? Because it achieved so little, really. I mean, the Weimar government achieved some progressive aims. And the way that the socialists came onto the streets and defeated the Beer Hall Putsch in 1924 is really outstanding. But when it came to it, there was a power vacuum, and then business as usual rushed to take its place.
I asked Kate Evans whether Rosa Luxemburg might think reform or revolution would be necessary today as we confront such crises as climate change. In other words, is there a place for evolution on the way to revolution?
Well, I would personally have the opinion that change is change. And I mean, she's very clear on her reform or revolution, which is not letting go of the idea of revolution as the goal that everyone should be working towards. And when she's talking about revolution, she's talking about radical system change. But it's also a very, very democratic idea in Luxembourgism. She's committed to, oh, there's just a marvellous quote. I'm sorry, I have to find it for you. History is not making things easy for us. A bourgeois revolution could simply overthrow the official power and replace it with a couple of new men. But we must work from the bottom to the top. We can only come to power with the clear and explicit will of the great majority of the proletarian masses. So she's committed to the idea that everybody is into the idea of social change. And maybe that is possible. We have such incredible horizontalism with modern means of communicating that I do think we now have the potential for much quicker shifts in public opinions and ideas than anybody has ever seen before. I think the way that the Arab Spring took off across large parts of the Middle East, and it's quite impressive, really, that people now have a way of organising, which has got real revolutionary potential. You know, I mean, it seems like capitalism is the neoliberal project is brooking no opposition, and it's sort of running away with itself. And it's creating a vast disenfranchised, disillusioned middle class who are steadily getting poorer because the 1% is sucking all the wealth in towards itself like a massive black hole. I don't think that's sustainable. I do think we are going to see change. I hope it's progressive social change.
I asked Kate Evans to talk about how she tackled communicating Rosa Luxemburg's complex economic and political ideas in graphic form in her biography, Red Rosa.
The process consisted of, I read through her letters, and then I read through her work, and then I tried to find all the tiny little tweetable bits of her work that summed up things that seemed important about, say, her opinions on the mass strike or her opinions on opportunism or whatever the theme was. And then I found that the storyline quite organically sprang from that, and I could kind of see it like a film in my head. Now, the fun thing about writing a cartoon book rather than writing a novel is that I basically got to draw that film, rather than doing sort of a straight biography, I got to create fictionalized scenes between people using actual words from the people involved, but I can change the setting. I mean, if I wanted to be completely, strictly faithful to life. What we would have is a cartoon book of Rosa Luxemburg sitting at a desk writing a letter to someone saying something. So instead of that, I would take, say, some really groovy bits from a letter to Leo Jogashes, her lover, and instead of having her writing it in a letter to him, I'd have them having a naked pillow fight just to make it a little bit more interesting. She's got some just brilliant quotes like, "I must take you in my claws and terrorize you completely. I have the right to do this because I'm 10 times better than you." And she's just brilliant. Really, really beautiful little phrases. So there's sort of three elements to the bits that make up the work. There's the explication, the bits where I'm trying to explain her concept of Marxism and of capitalism and inequality. And then there's the personal story where I'm sort of finding the drama that's there in her story of who she's with and what, how they reacted and what they all did. And then there are these little gems that are there in her letters, which are the most sublime bits of writing, where she's describing, say, the swallows flying over the prison yard where she's indefinitely imprisoned for opposing the First World War, or the clouds above the rooftops back when she was a girl gazing out of her bedroom window. And they're just little poetic jewels. And I knew as soon as I'd read those that just those on their own would be just beautiful things to pin together and create a story around. So I was so lucky. She's really inspirational. Her words are really beautiful and her work's really, really important.
Yeah, you mentioned Leo Jogashes, her lover. She actually had many lovers, and I have to say, you don't pull any punches in this book with the sex scenes. So it's
Well, I kind of enjoyed it, because how often do women actually get to make representations of sex and of female sexuality, and with hairy legs and hairy armpits? You know, it was really important to her. We've got her love letters, so we can see actually what she felt and how she was. So when she says things like, "If you no longer love me, then tell me to me openly. You can't help it." You know, that's something that she wrote. Those are her actual words.
We're talking with cartoonist Kate Evans about her graphic biography of the great revolutionary thinker and activist Rosa Luxemburg. It's called Red Rosa. You talked about, Kate Evans, you talk in the book about, and you just mentioned how she was arrested indefinitely. It wasn't the first time that she went to prison. She also had a really tragic end. And here, this also comes really alive on the page. Talk about how she died and how it was for you to write that, to draw that.
Oh, the page where she dies, I've saved the PDF, the Photoshop file with the title "Nasty, Nasty, Nasty." I just found it really hard because you're so strongly identified with someone when you're on a project like this. It was 3 years. I have photos of Rosa Luxemburg all over my studio, gazing down at me, and I'd be drawing her. In fact, I'd be drawing her naked in bed with some lover that's 14 years younger than her, and I'd just be going, "Oh my God, what could she? What if she could actually see me doing this? This is just crazy." You know, she'd become sort of a real person. She was a real person, but her story had become so personal to me. I feel like a personal sense of ownership over it. And then she's brutally murdered. And the maid, so soldiers pull her in to the Hotel Eden. And I've been to the site of the place where it was. And the maid comments, "I'll never forget how they knocked that poor woman down and knocked her about." And I just thought, that's just the one phrase that I had to go on. And so, yeah, that always the job of the writer, of the graphic biographer, is to find the drama within a scene. And so, you know, I had her last words, which were, "Don't shoot." And I thought, hang on, she's actually ordering them there not to shoot. And I think that's quite profound. She didn't give in right to the end. But then I find a way of framing that within the book, because maybe her death, I mean, it's tragic and sad, but maybe it's not the end of all the stories. There's a lot of new beginnings coming on from Rosa Luxemburg's work. So I hope I give a sense of continuity about that.
So the relevance for today, you say, what is still going on?
Well, Rosa Luxemburg was a theorist of revolution, so she would go out on the streets and interview people and ask them what motivated them to do the mass uprisings that they were involved in. She's got a lovely appreciation. It's interesting. Luxemburg's writing at a time where Marx has more or less said that revolution is preordained, that the workers must join together because it just makes sense that they will, and they will rise up because that's what workers do. I mean, he hadn't foreseen anything like the systems they have in China, whereby migrant workers only get to work in a factory for 3 years and then get booted out before they have a chance to develop any kind of solidarity. Obviously, capitalism's been a bit cleverer than Marx ever gave it credit for. But at that point, so people seem to think, well, socialism's just bound to happen. A revolution's just bound to happen. We just know that this is all going to collapse. Now, I think Luxemburg's right. It probably is going to collapse. It's whether it collapses into something better is the burning question. So she's struggling with this idea of the preordained scientific progressive march of history towards glorious revolution, and alternatively the idea, well, what if that isn't going to happen? And so she gets very interesting ideas about spontaneity and the way that really radical social change can sweep through a place. And those, her writings on the mass strike and on spontaneity are still relevant today. And you can draw direct parallels between, say, the Egyptian revolution, which had its roots in striking action, and the way that, and her analysis of what happened in Russia in 1905. The links between the bit in Accumulation of Capital, where she's talking about the link between militarism and globalisation and capitalism, is incredibly prescient. The way that capitalism keeps expanding to fill every kind of non-capitalist space is nowadays, we can see that kind of primary accumulation occurring within capitalist countries, as well as back when it was all about imperial expansion in Luxembourg's time. But now you can see the way that every kind of non-capitalist strata of society, like, for example, over here, the British health system is being taken over by capitalist corporate healthcare systems. It's being dismantled and privatised. All the, you know, the way that public utilities have been wholesale privatised within the last 30 years around the globe. And that is all primary accumulation. So it's incredibly prescient the way that she analyses quite how sort of unstoppably rampant capitalism is and how that's part of its mathematical raison d'etre. There isn't a way for it to not be like that.
Well, this is a terrific book. You really make Rosa Luxemburg into such a vivid, alive, full individual. And this has just been a fascinating conversation, Kate Evans. Your book is Red Rosa, A Graphic Biography of Rosa Luxemburg. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And that was Kate Evans talking about her graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg, Red Rosa. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to Kate Evans' work, including her powerful new cartoon about the migrant camp in Calais, France. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.